This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Welcome to School of Death. And a couple of things to start off with. I don't want to... I don't like creative writing as such, MacGyver's is an oxymoron as a pleonasm. So as a kind of way of mocking the creative writing workshop, the suicide note writing workshop, which we can write notes or we don't have to write notes. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to make light of the whole issue that this raises. And it's a topic which I'm very serious about, but it doesn't exclude humour. So that's the first thing to say. So I'm not here to gloat and dwell. It seems to me that suicide is something we should think about. And if you like, you know, there are stories about the increase in instances of suicide in the military on a regular basis. And then there was a story in the New York Times on May the 2nd about the increase in suicide amongst baby boomers, mm-hmm. which grabbed people's attention in circles that I move in. And it's interesting because the first thing to say is that there's that issue and how we think about suicide. And there's a very serious question for me, which is a philosophical and theological question, which is that suicide in antiquity was not a problem. Suicide in antiquity was not prohibited, and in certain circumstances it was expected. This was never done lightly, but when someone was asked to, or someone found themselves in a situation where it was, for example, Socrates, suicide or ostracism, you know, how we can even make sense of that choice? I mean, leave town or kill yourself, as Socrates decides to kill himself. Leaving Athens would be to cease to be human, as Nadia knows, at a cost. And people like Seneca, who was working for numerous emperors, finally Nero, you know, he fell out with the emperor, there was a corruption allegation, and he was required to kill himself. And he did. And it's a very long and botched suicide, and I document it in a book I wrote. But there was no prohibition against suicide. The context changes with Christianity, and it changes specifically with St. Augustine, and the argument is a very simple argument, not argument, the view is a very simple view. It's that life is something that's given to you, and it's something over which you have no dominion. So life is a datum, a given, and you have no dominion over life. If you commit suicide, you exert dominion over life, and you effectively you commit hubris, right? You assume the role only God can occupy. And I would wager that we still live within that worldview. Right? We don't see it as a specifically Christian worldview anymore, for the most part, but it's still the worldview that circumscribes most juridical and medical relationships to death, right? And then produces kind of weird debates like the whole Terry Schiavo debate a few years ago in the US and elsewhere. So, and in terms of the history of ideas, and this is interesting in relationship to the suicide note as a form. There was a completely obscure Italian thinker called Radicati di Passadana. And he wrote in 1732 in London, published in London, a philosophical dissertation on death. And this was the first text in whatever the West means, the West, to make the case for suicide. And he was chased out of London because there were a series of suicides directly inspired by this text. Famous suicide by two princes, or a prince and his family. Let me try to find this. This is and they left a note. They read, the family had read Radicati's pamphlet. This is also in 1732, and they left a note without a name. This is the Smiths, they were called. Gosh. The Smiths, very, very appropriate, very Morrissey lyric, those. Without a name, forever silent, dumb, dust, ashes, naught else is within this tomb. Where we were born or bred, it matters not who were our parents or hath us begot. We were and now are not. Think no more of us, for as we are, so you be turned to dust. And this became a famous case of a Richard Smith and his wife and kid, a printer, fallen into hard times and killed themselves. Radicati was chased out of London and went to the Netherlands, which was more tolerant of the United Provinces, and reconverted back to Protestantism and died in poverty some years later, to be forgotten. The first philosopher that argues for suicide is David Hume. And David Hume does this in a posthumous collection of essays edited by Adam Smith. There's an essay on immortality of the soul and an essay on suicide. And Hume thinks immortality of the soul is a very silly idea, and that suicide is something that people should be allowed to have the right over. The basic right for Hume is the right to have a right over one's existence, whether one lives or not. With the caveat that Hume says nobody ever threw their life away willy-nilly. Right? Something we could discuss. So the 18th century is the... And what's interesting about the 18th century is that there's this fantastic book that I recommend to you. It's out of print, called Or Not To Be by Mark Etkind, which actually Maurizio Catalan, who's connected with this space, is a big fan of this book. It's a collection of suicide notes. And the suicide note appears in the 18th century. Right? And that is the interesting thing. It appears with the rise of literacy, and it appears with the rise of newspapers. Suicide notes were published. So suicide notes weren't written in continuity. Seneca didn't leave, they weren't suicide notes. So the suicide note is something which is to do with the rise of literacy and the rise of publicity, particularly the press. So the first thing you have to say then is that the suicide note as a genre, as a form, is a kind of exhibitionism. It's a kind of publicity. And when we read suicide notes, we are part of that exhibitionism, which means that suicide notes for us are a kind of pornography. Right? And this book is fascinating because it's not tremendously deep in terms of its analysis, but it's got wonderful examples, some of which I'll read out. And in a sense, you want to read the notes, and you feel a kind of sick fascination in reading them. We become voyeurs on something which is hidden or forbidden. So suicide notes exert a kind of sick attraction because they feel prohibited, but they're a genre which was developed in order to be publicized, in order to be published in newspapers. And that's itself really interesting. So suicide notes are attempts at communication. That's the first thing. They're attempts at communication. They're some last desperate attempt at communication. They're failed communications, you could say, or they're final communications, but they're attempts to communicate. And you could say that if the great horror that most of us have in some corner of our heads is the horror of dying alone, right? Then a suicide note is a way of not dying alone. One is addressing a note to someone. Right? So that act of address means that there's someone else is involved in one is not alone. This exhibitionism in the suicide note is, you could say, a characteristic of the melancholic person. The odd, now, this is my son Soren's, my wife Jameson. Jameson's a psychoanalyst and Soren isn't a psychoanalyst yet. But probably, who knows. Why did I mention? Oh, Freud. Freud makes very interesting remarks about suicide in Mourning and Melancholia, and we've written a book on Hamlet, which is coming out in about a month, about 6 weeks. And Hamlet, you know, when everyone says the most famous work in English literature, blah blah blah, the greatest play by Shakespeare, the greatest poet, whatever nonsense one says, the first time we meet Hamlet in Hamlet, he's contemplating suicide. Right? And it's a debate which runs throughout the whole play. You know, if the Everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter, Hamlet says, I might do it. Right? So in Hamlet there is this prohibition which is divine against suicide, but he's constantly figuring in his melancholy. And the melancholic, as Freud says, the melancholic isn't just sort of going, oh God, it's so fucking awful. The melancholic is loudly proclaiming their melancholy. The other thing about Hamlet is that Hamlet as a melancholic is a very loud melancholic. And melancholics can be very loud, right? Which is something we, you know, you think about, I don't know, Woody Allen or something like that, you know, someone complaining endlessly about their symptoms. And so it's not, there's something going on there. So, Freud then goes on to say, which is, you know, kind of something it sounds controversial, but I think it's something we need to think about, and it shows how much that we don't think about suicide. He says that suicide is a sadism that flows from intense self-love. He says, so great is our self-love that we are pushed towards our own destruction. Right? So, do you want to say something about that, James? Would you say something about that?
Yeah, you want to.
Well, I think the great thing in Freud's Mourning and Melancholia is the tie that he makes between narcissism and melancholia. He says that you know, it's the sort of last stop before the psychosis, which is why in melancholia you can actually become quasi-psychotic. You can go into psychotic depression. And it's something about what Freud will call the withdrawal of cathexis from the world into the ego. So it's a hyper-inflation of the ego at the cost of the destruction of the value of the world. As the world becomes meaningless, as all of this energy is kind of drawn inward into the ego. And he says, within the ego, you bury your kind of love object, the loss, in yourself. And it becomes, he says, like a gangrenous sore, almost like a vacuum inside of yourself. And it's this kind of internal vacuum within the ego, within narcissism, that fuels what he calls the great nuisance of the melancholic.
Nuisance.
It's very funny. He says, they make a great nuisance themselves. They don't have the shame that you would expect of someone who feels so worthless.
The root of the word melancholy is
melancholy, which means the black bile.
The black bile, yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
John Berryman, the poet's suicide note was, I am a nuisance. And he also wrote a poem about describing me. So, It's an unpleasant kind of set of affairs, right? I mean, think about Hamlet. I mean, Hamlet, you know, what is the world? You know, it delights not me. It is just a stale promontory. You know? So for Hamlet, the world is just dust and ashes. And he is dust and ashes too, right? Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither. He's consumed with a loathing for himself and a disgust with himself, and the world is empty, and he proclaims this endlessly. And
Well, Freud says that all suicide is murder, and that you're killing some sort of hated object within the self, some identification that you have. And you see this really powerfully actually in the Mark Eckhart book, because the letters are sometimes viciously addressed to someone else. As if, you know, with this act or with this letter, you're going to stick them with you and their death for the rest of their life. And you really, really see that sort of connection. And Freud's talking about this collapse between ego and object, and how it plays out within the melancholic frame of mind. And it's perfect in this book. It's also a great ambivalence between love and hate. And I think my favorite note is, "Dear Betty, I hate you, love George."
Hate you, love George. That's the ambivalence. That's the ambivalence, right?
I hate you,
yeah. I present this picture of a, so I wish to be buried.
No.
I present this picture of another woman. The girl I thought I married. May you always remember I loved you once but died hating you. So one thing that the suicide note does is to proclaim love and hate, which can be hate for someone, you know, and the situation there is one of, you know, I think it makes sense to me, because so I'll kill myself, then you'll finally realize who, you know, then you'll miss me, you know, then you'll realize what I did for you, then I'll be finally vindicated. Right? It's the idea of the indignant suicide note, this hate-filled out of a disappointed love, there's that. And there's tons of other examples, but I want to read them all out. There was actually Anne and Derek Humphrey, who founded the Hemlock Society, and Anne eventually killed herself, and her note to Derek was, "There, you got what you wanted. Ever since I was diagnosed as having cancer, you've done everything conceivable to precipitate my death. You will have to live with this until you die. May you never ever forget." All the best, Anne. So there's that hate, love. That's the basic issue is hate and love, and the shift in between the two, the ambivalence and the shift in the two registers. But one always speaks to someone else in a suicide note. That can be to, you know, there's another example here, "Bow Wow and Goodbye, comma, Pepper," from a man to his dog, right? Or it can be, "God forgive me, a minister scrawled this note before hanging himself in his church." One addresses someone, it can be a dog, it can be God. Hey, one word spelled backward is the other word. Most suicides occur between the hours of noon and 6 p.m. There's an association between the moon and suicide. The peak isn't around the full moon, but around the new moon. Coffee drinkers are less likely to commit suicide. Suicide attempts for women are common during menstruation and the days directly preceding it. Women who use birth control pills attempt suicide more often than those who use a diaphragm. Men with tattoos are more likely to use guns in their suicide, while those with brown eyes are more likely to choose hanging or poison. I didn't know all of that. Also, the question of when most suicides happen. People think that suicides happen around the holiday period, right? Christmas, New Year, or whatever. Most suicides happen in May, June. So this story, this May the 2nd story, fits that, and it's interesting that it's suicides tend to happen when things are beginning to lift. Yeah? As a sign of hope, strength.
This is why, as a shrink, you have to be very careful when a patient gets better. It's actually when they're really depressed and they're lying in bed that they're not going to.
So what is that?
In the Freudian model, because of this total internal withdrawal, right, there's usually a loss of even just energy. But then when they start to sort of reinvest in the world, there's a capacity for action. It's a very tenuous moment. Lacan and Freud also always still on that cusp of disappointment and rage. So that's the moment that you're sort of more able to act it out.
And the there's a suicide note out of a kind of pride or indignancy. I mean, Hitler's suicide note. My wife and I choose to die in order to escape the shame of overthrow or capitulation. It's our wish for our bodies to be cremated immediately on the place where I performed the greater part of my daily work during 12 years of service to my people. Hermann Göring, after the Nuremberg trials, there are three suicide notes, all of which express outrage and indignation. And this is another feature of suicide notes is a kind of obsession with one detail. The detail in Göring's case was that he found out he was going to be hanged and not shot. And he says, the general of the German Luftwaffe could be shot, but being hanged is too shameful. Therefore, I will take the poison that I've been concealing in my anus for the last 6 months. But after writing a whole series of... there's actually O.J. Simpson wrote notes but didn't go through with the act. Another thing which is the idea of the suicide, what happens in this kind of splitting in the self, what Freud calls narcissism. Narcissism is not as identity with myself, with my image, but as a kind of splitting. So that what we often find in suicide notes, this is from Fanny Imlay Godwin, half-sister of Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. I've long determined the best thing I could do was to put an end to the existence of a being whose birth was unfortunate, and it goes on. So you objectify yourself. You are a being, you're a creature, you're a worthless piece of dirt. And see, what you're killing, this is Freud's point, is not yourself, you're killing that thing that is an excrescence which should be eliminated. So, other categories... this is just some notes I'm making this morning. This is just discussed here a tiny bit, but we'd have to think about it now, would be, altruistic suicide, in quotation marks. What is the logic of the suicide of the suicide bomb? Right? And there's usually it's an address to God. Again, it's an address to God in relationship to a world that is fallen and decaying, so one sacrifices oneself in the name of the other who is God, with the promise of redemption or not, and we see a lot of that now, right? The suicide note, I guess, has been eclipsed by the suicide video tape. That's a whole issue. Hunger strike, yes.
So we had Harry Carey, we had
Yeah, self-immolation, Buddhist priests during Vietnam. Yeah, absolutely. And
then even a lot of suicide notes now in Greece against economic measures.
Right.
I mean, there are suicides happening in the main square of Athens.
Really?
And there's a note saying that this is because we're desperate, because of the economic situation. So here's a kind of a suicide note being a political statement.
Right. So that's something to think about very carefully, it seems to me. Or as a, it's another aspect of that. There's another example here, which is suicide as a business decision. This is from a suicide note. This is from Alex C, who battled the IRS for a number of years, and who became financially destitute. And he says to his wife, "I've taken my life in order." This is extraordinarily painful. "I've taken my life in order to provide capital for you. The IRS and its liens, which have taken against our property illegally by a runaway agency of our government, have dried up all the sources of credit for us. So I've made the only decision I can. It's purely a business decision. I hope you can understand that. I love you completely. ... You will find my body on the lot on the north side of the house." Now, when that story went up in the Times on May the 2nd, I was looking at the comments this morning. A lot of the comments are like that, people that have killed themselves because they got thrown out of their jobs, they got no credit, they got no money, they got no savings. So you come to a rational conclusion of, well, I will kill myself. A practical decision. I think that's really, you know, in the US right now with the kind of baby boomer flow, and that's what we're looking at. It's not, we're not talking about so much a suicide of despair. There's obviously despair in this, but a kind of suicide of, this is what's happened, this is what I've got, what the options are, therefore I will end it.
In like rural India as well, like in the farming community, it's like epidemic.
Really?
Yeah.
Say some more about that.
Yeah, male farmers in India, like tens of thousands in the last.
It's a quarter of a million.
Sorry?
Quarter of a million in the last 10.
Oh, is it? Yeah, it's like a staggering amount of people.
Really?
Just no, zero option, I guess. No
quarter of a million suicides?
Yeah. Nothing, nowhere to go.
Just jump in, and because I've just got some odds and ends here, but it doesn't really add up. But one that I wanted to mention was Kurt Cobain, because we know the story of Kurt Cobain, but his suicide note is read by Courtney Love, and she says these are her words, right? The note should be pretty easy to understand. All the wording's from Punk Rock 101. This is her. I haven't felt the excitement of listening. And now this is now Kurt Cobain. I haven't felt the excitement of listening to, as well as creating music, along with reading and writing for too many years now. I've tried everything that's in my power to appreciate it, and I do. God believe me, I do. I was one of those narcissists who only appreciate things when they're alone. I'm too sensitive. I need to be slightly numb in order to regain the enthusiasm I had as a child. It goes on, but since the age of 7, I've become hateful towards all humans in general. I'm too much of an erratic, moody baby. I don't have the passion anymore, and so remember, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Peace, love, empathy, Kurt Cobain. And then Courtney goes on to say, just tell him that he's a fucker, okay? And that you love him. So what you get there is the kind of rage, he's reading out the suicide note, and the rage linked to that, and
he signs it Kurt Cobain. He signs his last name as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure. He also there was a Hamlet obsession with. There's another suicide note from Rome the same year. I think it's, when did he kill himself? He kills himself in April or March or April 1994. April the 5th, 1994. There's a suicide note from Rome in, I think, February or March, where it says something like, like Hamlet, I have to choose between life and death. I choose death. Right? So, or not to be, as it were. Virginia Woolf, who feared she was going mad again, and she takes her life because she feels she's being taken over by something she no longer has the strength to fight. Kleist. Oh, and this is the effect Kurt Cobain. This is the, what's called the Werther effect, you know, The Sorrows of Young Werther by Goethe in the late 18th century produced a whole spate of suicides. And in relation to Kurt Cobain, a 20-year-old man accidentally shot himself to death at his apartment while imitating the suicide of Kurt Cobain. As his friends watched early Monday, the man propped a 12-gauge shotgun on the floor and knelt with his mouth over the barrel, Sergeant Jim Hansen said. He wasn't intending to hurt himself, Sergeant Hansen said. He just put the gun up to his head and said, look, I'm just like Kurt Cobain. And the gun went off. That's a kind of a very macabre version, twist on the young Werther effect. Another thing is the, which is partly there in Hamlet, is the, which James and I were talking about a little bit, is the identification with the dead, right? If one lives in relationship to the dead. Now, in Hamlet, the dead is the dead father.
who wants it. But if we think about the death, the suicide of Holocaust survivors, right? And there are obviously famous ones like Paul Celan, Primo Levi and others. I mean, what does one make of that? Well, the survivor guilt, but what does that really mean? What are we thinking? Now, you were talking about this earlier on, but it was good. Better than what I said. The identification with the death, as it were.
It was when I was at a talk where they were talking about genocide jokes. Actually, like humor and genocide, and they were talking about some of the humorous stories about the Holocaust, like this way, ladies and gentlemen, to the gas chambers. I forget who wrote that. But the psychoanalyst who was talking about this kind of humor was talking about how it's very dangerous because who are these books written for? They're written for the dead. The address is to the dead, and it's very dangerous because within a short time you could go and join the person to whom you're always speaking. And certainly that's an issue of survivor guilt, but I think it's deeper than that, especially in the way that Freud talks about what it means to sort of collapse who you are and the lost object into yourself, which is sort of at the heart of the Freud.
The next kind of set phenomena, whatever that's the right term, I don't know, are suicide with others. And there's a whole part of this book about the phenomenon of the copycat suicides. The Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco is famous for its suicides. There's plenty of other bridges to choose, but that's the one you go from, right? And John Berryman went from there and others. And there's one suicide note which is just, I and my daughter have committed suicide. A simple note left by a man who jumped with his 5-year-old daughter. And this links to the, I don't have any way of analysing this yet, but to kill oneself along with one's loved ones, killed kids, whatever. And we might think about this as the Medea complex, right? Medea, who is it? Theseus, who's it? Jason in Medea. Yeah,
Jason,
you know, comes back and says, look, I've got this new wife, and it's going to be good for the family because we're going to get out of the financial hole that we're in and everything will be fine. So I'm going to marry this new woman and don't worry. It's all for you and the kids. And she
it's
says,
a business decision.
It's a business. It's purely a business decision. And she says, fuck you. And she goes down with herself and the kids, right? And so there's that sort of debt with others, which is... And the most kind of... macabre, that's the wrong term. The most... extreme example of that, I was doing some, if you can call watching videos research, I was doing some research earlier this week on the Jonestown massacre, as it's usually called, and Jim Jones and the People's Temple. And all that people usually know about Jim Jones is the fact that there was this mass death, suicide, whatever, in 1978 in Guyana. There's a whole prehistory to this, which is fascinating. And you know, Jim Jones's People's Temple was a church, a Protestant church based on racial integration and a socialist gospel. Right? So Jim Jones, like many other people, interpreted Christ's message as being inconsistent with private property ownership. So it's collective ownership of property. So this is a kind of socialist collective that, after what they see as persecution, end up in Guyana building paradise. And then after the visit of a congressman, because certain people were... There were stories getting back to the States that people wanted to get out of the church and they couldn't, a congressman went out to visit, and the congressman was eventually shot, and then 909 people drink cyanide in Kool-Aid and die. And what's extraordinary, and you can watch, there's a very good Frontline or PBS documentary on this. And throughout the mass deaths, he's giving a sermon, and he's sort of exhorting them to do this. And he says, you know, suicide is not, this is not suicide, this is a revolutionary act. This is a revolutionary act of lying down with me and with God against the enemy who will destroy us. So that sense of which the kind of paranoid collective suicide is another, I don't think you could even other phenomena like that.
I mean, you could imagine a companion volume to Dr. David might be called To Be, where people perhaps write themselves into life. What starts as a suicide letter ends up becoming the externalization of the self, or whatever ends up having some sort of salutary function. But we wouldn't know if these, or maybe these are works of art.
Well,
that's what we're going to do today. That's the workshop today, right?
Okay.
The notes today, right?
We could move towards that now. I've said pretty much what I wanted to say.
I was going to ask you a little bit about you talked about temporality and publicity and the fact that, you know, with the rise of literacy, suicide notes didn't exist, obviously, at a certain point, but you don't think before the rise of the newspaper explanations were ever offered for suicide? Is that what, I mean, we wouldn't necessarily know via text that's been left behind of that. Would one have explained oneself if you're, you know, a Roman to your family?
It wouldn't have been necessary. It would have been
obvious.
Yes.
It would have been clear.
Yeah.
Because you would do it under certain circumstances that are culturally legible.
And you sometimes do it with somebody else as well. So Seneca commits suicide with his wife. And she didn't need to commit suicide but decides to go with him. There's a very case of Arthur Kersler and his wife Cynthia. They both commit suicide at the same time. Kersler's powers are fading. And he was tightly linked with the right to live movements and all of that. He decides to kill himself, and Cynthia, who's perfectly healthy, dies at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of almost what's often seen as a kind of coercion there for the beauty of the joint suicide. And as someone commented on the Arthur and Cynthia Kirtler case with the following line, I'm going to kill myself, comma, aren't we? and the other really, as it were, perverse to us version of that is the great German writer Kleist, Heinrich von Kleist, who wanted to die and forms a suicide pact with Henrietta von Vogel, or something, I forget who it is, and they go out to the Wannsee outside Berlin, and they set up a table, have tea, and there are, you know, presumably there are servants there, and then he takes out a gun, shoots her, and shoots himself, and the whole thing is kind of documented. So there's that way of not dying alone. But that's so I guess what conclusions have we come to?
So, you know, in Greek tragedy, a lot of the classicists talk about how male suicides take place on stage and female suicides take place off stage.
Mm.
And in particular, with female suicides, it prompts the chorus to speak about what's happened. There's always this announcement as to what the woman has done and what's happened, whereas the men fall on their swords and whatever it is. Yet it seems almost like an inverse between an act that prompts speech and discussion or whatever dramatic action versus the fact that there's a taboo, I think, about speaking about suicide, and it's the person who's suiciding who's the one who's narrating their own.
Also the technique that, I mean, in Greek tragedy, men kill themselves with their sword, like in Ajax, Sophocles' Ajax. Virgins tend to be hanged.
No, the virgin's throats
are. Well, I guess Iphigenia, right? Iphigenia. Who gets hanged?
Women hang themselves.
Brides are hanged. So this then raises the question of the means of dispatch. And the most popular instrument for suicide in this country is obviously the gun. But that varies enormously from place to place in terms of what people will do. I guess now it's going to be through medication. But basically, you know, it's not hard to get a gun, but that might seem messy and beastly or whatever. But yeah. Please.
Are there any genres, I guess you could say, of suicide in which it's precisely because it's perceived as a transgression that there's a kind of like a mechanism of a kind of redemption through transgression idea, that through the suicide they're redeeming themselves?
Yes.
And I'm just curious where maybe that would be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the, yeah, so the public suicide where, well, the suicide bomb is like that, right?
Right.
The suicide bomb is an act of suicide which is redemptive.
But the people who are guilty in Mark Eckhine's book, the people who have done some wrong, in their suicide notes never admit to wrong, at least in the way that he sets it up, which is amazing. And, you know, they've already been, the cat's out of the bag, and they still in their notes declare their innocence. So, I mean, there is a redemptive factor, but it's interesting about how it flies in the face of the reality of the film. It's never like an admission of guilt. I think this is terrible to myself. It's like, I have this wrong.
With the suicide bombers, though, I think that's an interesting, that seems to be kind of straddling the side of, is that really transgression, though? I mean, I guess in other circumstances it would be a transgressive act, but in this case it's explained or excused away. But I was actually thinking of something that maintains, can it ever maintain its transgressive state in the act and not be explained away, as this is the one exception for it. There seems to be a distinction there between the suicide bombing. It's not exactly maybe what I was thinking
about. Don't you think that if it was really transgressive, that it would be doing something more interesting?
Yeah.
Than writing suicide notes? I mean, that's one of the things about the book, is that they're not, there's no great suicide notes. They're filled with pathos.
They're not
ultimately that interesting.
Actually,
the one fake note in there, which is by Ken Kesey, who did it, who tried to run away to Mexico because he was busted for taking acid, is probably one of the most interesting ones. Precisely what he's fake.
Where is that? It's a great one.
It's on 54.
Okay, last words of Ken Kesey, you know, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. A vote for Gary Goldwater is a vote for fun. the Fort Bragg sign, and that means the ocean, and that means time to drop the acid. Not that I really need it, mind you. I've got courage enough without chemical assistance. It's just that I'm scared. Driving along, check the abyss at my left like I'm shopping for real estate prospects. Ocean, 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 I'll beat you in the end. I'll go through with my heels at your hungry ribs. I've lost the ocean again, beautiful. I drive hundreds of miles looking for my particular cliff, get tripped behind acid. I can't find the ocean, end up slamming into a redwood, just like I could have slammed into a home, beautiful. So I, Ken Kesey, being of ahem, sound mind and body, do hereby leave the whole scene to fate, corporation, cash, the works, and Babs to run it. It occurs to me here that nobody's going to buy this prank, and now it occurs to me that even that I like. It occurs to me that I like that even better. It doesn't kill himself.
It's also a different genre, isn't it? It's
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's like
the
world.
It's actually the thing of the identification with the dead, that a lot of people suicide. One of the conventions of the genre seems to be that you speak as though you're already dead. So that's the case of jumping off with the child. We have committed suicide, and also
exactly
the
tenses of the works, right?
Yeah,
the tenses
of the position is that, and it's of course the Hamlet gives a precedent for that, because
yeah.
I mean, that ratio is a position that allows the writing as a word to be alive.
Hamlet says, "I am dead," Horatio, three times before he dies. But the tenses are very interesting. You know?
We are in this poem, like the. That's a testament of the Hank Mack, because he was condemned to die, but then was commuted. So what he wrote was like a poem. So it's actually a really good piece of writing, but he doesn't kind of die. He has Nietzsche's passion.
Can I ask quickly about, you did mention Nietzsche's idea of local death, but I just thought maybe that would be something that Nietzsche talks about willful death.
Right.
Death is, he might use the word suicide, the idea of, but it seems, does that is one of the only true acts of will.
Agency.
Yeah, I mean, it's the logic of... I don't know that context, but I mean, in relationship to Nietzsche, it's the debate that he gets from reading the Russians, Turgenev and Dostoevsky, right, where, I forget, the character of Kirillov in Dostoevsky, who, having found everything meaningless, is making a study of suicides as a preparation for his own. Right? So in a sense, there's this moment in the late 19th century of nihilism as a declaration of nothingness, and therefore suicide becomes the greatest possible aesthetic act as well. And nothing was the great in terms of we're art in a gallery, right? Suicide as a work of art. And I guess the closest that I can think of in relationship to that is the death of a Mishima, the Japanese author who dies at 45. And he dies firstly through, you know, and again, it's a detail. He's upset with the status of the Japanese army, and the Japanese police authorities are usurping the function that he thinks should be given to the army. So it's this question of what is army and what is police duty. It's a very kind of, you know.
Was it the harakiri?
But then he gives a speech to police officers when they start to harangue him. They start to, you know, say, "Ah, shut up, you banker," or whatever. And then he withdraws, and then he kneels down, and he puts an 18-centimeter wound within himself, but can't quite complete it, and is then struck by his assistant twice, and that doesn't quite work properly. But there you've got the idea of suicide as the perfect artistic mistake. Right? There was a favourite author of mine, Maurice Blanchot. And Maurice Blanchot writes this text called L'instant de ma mort, The Moment of My Death. In this text, he talks about a moment when he was, it's unclear quite where this is happening, in occupied France. It's unclear what's going on, but he was rounded up by some soldiers. They thought were German, but turned out to be Russian. And there's some, the whole thing is wrapped in a kind of ambiguity. Anyway, they're going to be shot. They're going to be shot. Six people in a line, and Blanchot's end of that line. And at that moment, he says, he felt, which is in French, something like a légèreté extraordinaire, extraordinary lightness, an exhilaration. And then, for reasons also unknown, they decide not to shoot. And they disperse. And then he tries to deal with the rest of it. So for him, for example, Blanchot, at that point, this would have been the perfect moment, which he was denied. So there is that Nietzschean idea of, and I'm very suspicious of that, but it's there. In Benjamin, you've got the threat of the border police between France and Spain. But again, there are different stories about what happened then. There's a sense in which some people say, well, that's a kind of giving up at that point, or a kind of, I don't know. So,
does the book give a sense of revision? How many of these things are revised or worked on? Or how spontaneous? Does the book give a sense of notes that were revised or thought about and then, you know? How spontaneous are the notes? We don't know. The book doesn't give us a sense of working on your suicide notes, like drafts or whatever.
It's like that, it's kind of diary. You know,
diary.
Last moments diary. It's like, I'm waiting.
Yeah. The diary, or people actually writing as they're expiring. I guess the diary would be the closest to the...
That would be a pill or something.
smell of gas fumes. It would be 6:34 p.m. civilian time. It's getting rather dark, so that I smart a bit, afraid somebody will come by now. This is slow. 6:36 p.m. Engine sounds smooth. Faculties seem temporarily sharpened. I still smart. One man objected when I stopped on his property. Can't blame him, actually. Seems that there are more gas fumes now and good than anything else right now. Muscles used in writing in need of a rest. I'm afraid somebody will come. Elbows especially and wrists. Where's the will? No particular desire to get out. Seems to be getting the better of being fast. It's been just 15 minutes now. I wonder what it's going to be like. Chest filling up fast. Seems to be terrific pressure first. Legible scrawling.
Who is that?
This is just a sort of anonymous person.
That reminds me of who is the sailor who, the British sailor in the circumnavigation, and he loved, he was calling in false. He felt pressured. Yeah, he was logging in false calls at the same time, and then writing his own kind of demands. There were these two logs, one of his own suicide and one of his own.
Yeah, that's right. That's good. So what now?
How did B.S. Johnson do this? And just being he's in the peaks of the basis of his novels and his films. Batman on the Beach?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I have a feeling he walked into the ocean, which would be nice if Batman on the Beach.
Like Reginald Perrin.
Yeah.
Death by Drowning. Yeah, T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. Yeah, so I don't know. What we could do, an actual writing workshop now, or we just discuss having given you the different categories under which.
Yeah, exactly.
Or we could talk about it.
I'd like to.
Whatever.
I think it'd be nice to try and write. No, or I don't know. Would it be good or no?
Let's say it's a few minutes past three, so we have plenty of time left in the writing workshop.